dodging the blow. He hoisted Keenfire above his head, whirled round, and drew the axe across the orc's belly. The blade sliced through the fat-smeared armour as if it weren't there, spilling green gore and intestines. The disemboweled orc groaned and toppled to the ground. Tungdil raised his axe. "Any more takers?" The orcs shrank away and hollered for their archers. The dwarves behind Tungdil seized their chance and clambered out of the shaft. Soon there were 30 of them, standing shoulder to shoulder in a circle, weapons hefted and ready to counter an enemy attack. Meanwhile, Ireheart was rampaging through the hordes. He darted and bounded between the orcs and the Bognelim, felling beast after beast. Tungdil lost sight of him, but he could hear the secondling's frenzied laughter as he baited the enemy by oinking like a runt. Glancing up, Tungdil caught sight of Prince Malin's cavalry approaching from the north. The riders were charging down the hillside in a line measuring 500 paces across. Beasts and Bognelim were trampled to the ground.
"Get back, Boindil!"
he shouted anxiously. Behind him, the last of the dwarves were clamouring out of the shaft. Tungdil's troop of 100 warriors was complete.
"Aren't you coming?"
called Boindil, cheerfully from somewhere in the scrum. His voice was barely audible amid the sound of buckling armour and the shrieks of the dying beasts. Tungdil gripped the haft of Keenfire with both hands and squared his shoulders. His eyebrows knitted together in a determined frown.
"I'm coming," he murmured softly.
Then he raised his voice to a shout.
"Drive them forward!"
His warriors let out a fearsome battle cry and fanned out, brandishing their hammers and axes as they threw themselves on the startled beasts. Tungdil and Keenfire led the attack. Nothing could stop the formidable blade as it sang through the air, slicing shields, hewing armor and chainmail, severing limbs, and killing strings of orcs with every blow. The dwarves carved a path through the hordes, undeterred by the stinking blood and the vile smell of their enemies' grease-encrusted armor. Green gore splashed from the gushing wounds, and dismembered limbs thudded to the ground to be trampled underfoot by the indomitable dwarves. Soon the warriors at the rear were clambering over enemy corpses, but they pressed on regardless, determined to free Girdlegard from the pestilent orcs. The resistance soon dried up. The bravest beasts died in combat, while those of a less courageous nature fled at the sight of the grim-faced dwarves.
"After them!"
shouted Tungdil. The strategy paid off. Driven forward by the dwarves, the orcs and Bognelim collided with their comrades, who were running from Malin and his men. The beasts were doomed. Swinging his axe, Tungdil took aim at a couple of orcs. Even as the blade swung toward them, the beasts keeled over, felled by an invisible hand. To Tungdil's astonishment, Ireheart popped up from behind the corpses. He was soaked with the blood of countless orcs, and his eyes were glinting dangerously.
"I was wondering where you'd got to," he said cheerfully. "What kept you? Don't tell me you were having trouble with the runts."
"I was yelling at you to come back,"
scolded Tungdil, shaking his head.
"Oh," said Boindil. "I assumed you were talking to them."
He pointed to the fleeing beasts. Sighing contentedly, he contemplated the battle.
"A good end to the Orbit, eh?"
He raised his gore-spattered axes.
"Come on, we're not finished yet."
Suddenly a shadow crossed his face.
"To be honest, scholar, it isn't much fun without my brother. The two of us would have wiped the floor with the runty little beasts. The next 20 are for him."
He charged off, bellowing ferociously at the top of his voice.
"His fiery spirit will be the death of him,"
murmured the dwarf next to Tungdil. Soon he too was slashing his way through the orcs.
"Please, Vrakus," prayed Tungdil. "Don't let Boindil come to any harm."
He dropped back a few paces and placed the bugle to his lips, playing a sequence of notes that Malin would recognize as a signal that the dwarfs had arrived and were closing in from the opposite side. There was a danger that Malin's archers would loose their deadly arrows at the dwarven warriors, who were hard to spot from a distance, especially when surrounded by orcs. He waited for Malin's bugle to reply, then caught up with the rest of his company and launched himself into the fray. The dwarves were still fighting at sundown, and Malin's infantry joined the action, which didn't please Boindil at all. Some of the orcs and Bognilim were intent on escaping, but Malin was ready for them, and the attempt to leave the battlefield was blocked by a unit of riders with lances. By nightfall, there was barely room to step around the corpses, and the channels of meltwater were awash with green blood. The dwarves and men met on the southernmost hill above Prince Malin's camp. The prince turned his horse and cantered over to Tungdil, dismounted and held out his hand. Save for a nick in his forearm and some damage to his armor, he seemed to be unscathed.
"Tungdil Geldhand," he said respectfully, "praise the gods for your safe arrival."
It wasn't often that an ordinary dwarf was greeted so courteously by a human king. Tungdil grinned and took Malin's hand.
"Another decisive victory for the men and the dwarves."
They gazed down at the battlefield. Every last orc had been destroyed.
"The good folk of Goregar can sleep easy tonight."
The prince's face darkened.
"Some are sleeping in eternal slumber. We saw plundered villages and burned out houses on our way."
He turned his face to the darkening sky and stared at the glittering stars.
"You're right, though. The people of Goregar need fear no more." "Trust the Long'uns to start without us," grumbled Boindil in a voice that, while quieter than usual, was loud enough for the prince to hear. "You can't startle the runts with your horses and expect them to put up a fight."
Slowly he crossed his powerful arms in an exaggerated movement in front of his chest and glared accusingly at the riders. Malin knew how to handle the hot-blooded warrior. Realizing that Boindil hadn't intended him to hear, he decided not to argue.
"We'll wait for you next time," he promised. "It's a shame you were late." "Late?"
echoed Boindil indignantly, sticking his chin in the air and setting his beard a-quiver.
"It's a wonder we got here at all. The confounded earthquake caused havoc in the tunnels. Warped rails, boulders on the line, some of them bigger than a troll's backside. Just be thankful we..."
"That's enough, Boindil,"
ruled Tungdil, interrupting the warrior's outburst.
"He's right, you know. We were late."
He turned to the prince and rolled his eyes apologetically, signalling that Malin should let the matter lie.
"Luckily for us, it didn't make any difference. We triumphed in the end."
Tungdil could see the amusement in the ruler's eyes.
"What a victory for Girdlegard,"
agreed Malin with an earnest nod.
"We'd still be fighting if it weren't for the dwarves."
It was unusual for him to tolerate rudeness, but no one had overheard the conversation, and Boindil was a special case. Boindil considered the prince's conciliatory words and perked up considerably. He pulled off his helmet, letting his long black plate unfurl down his back, and rubbed his stubbly cheeks. Sweat was trickling down his face.
"I suppose you're right," he said. "We had our fun with the orcs, and Vrakus will be happy with us for wiping out the beasts."
He cleared his throat.
"Sorry about my temper, Malin," he mumbled,
forgetting that it was customary to address a prince with more respect.
"Apology accepted,"
the ruler of Eidoslane said magnanimously. He pointed to the collection of tents where his army was camped.
"I see the supply wagons have arrived. There's plenty of dark ale for everyone."
Perhaps you'll join us in celebrating the destruction of the beasts.
Don't mind if I do, said Boindil, setting off toward the tents.
His thirst led him straight to the beer barrels, which were several times the standard size. The other dwarfs looked questioningly at Tungdil, who nodded for them to follow. Malin's men, buoyed by the prospect of a night without marching, hurried back to camp. Malin and Tungdil lingered on the hilltop, watching the victorious warriors gather around the campfires to eat and make merry. A cycle ago I was in exile, the prince said slowly. I never thought I'd wear the crown of my forefathers, and I never imagined the rulers of Gerdlegard would join together in an alliance of men, elves, and dwarves. Tungdil thought about all that had happened to him. After travelling across Gerdlegard on an errand for his Magus, he had been nominated against his wishes as the High King's successor, and journeyed to the Black Saddle without realizing that Vrakas had chosen him to wield Keenfire and kill Nodon on behalf of the dwarves. Adversity brought us together. A cycle ago my kinsfolk were ready to wage war on the elves. Malin laughed grimly. At least Nodon was good for something. He put an end to our feuding. Tungdil nodded. Nodon gave us the spark of solidarity, but it's our responsibility to keep it alive. He leaned forward, resting his weight on Keenfire. We need an everlasting flame in which the bonds between us can be reforged. He looked down at the feasting and merriment below. How many did you lose?
50 men and as many horses, said Malin.
More were wounded, but we were heavily outnumbered. It could have been worse. We were lucky. A few gashes and a couple of broken bones, but nothing to speak of. I think Vrakas wanted us to live. He lost so many of his children at the Black Saddle that his smithy must be full.
The prince laid a hand on the dwarf's shoulder.
Come, Tungdil Goldhand. We should celebrate our victory before the long journey home.
Tungdil knew he was right. Tomorrow he would set off through the tunnels, pack up his things at the Secondling Kingdom, and head west to the Firstlings in the Red Range. From there he would journey north with the dwarves who had elected to join him, and set up home in the ancient Fifthling Kingdom. In time, a new folk descended from Borengar, Beroin, and Goimdil would populate the Grey Range. And Tungdil's promise to Giselbert Ironeye, founding father of the Fifthlings, would be fulfilled. He knew it wouldn't be easy. While the stone gateway was open, there was nothing to stop orcs and other beasts crossing into Gerdlegard and taking up residence in the abandoned dwarfen halls.
Don't let there be too many of them, he begged his creator
as he walked down the hillside with Malin.
We can't keep fighting forever.
They were still some distance away when they heard Boindil's voice. He was singing a ballad that the dead companion, Bavragor Hammerfist, had often sung.
At least Boindil will be happy if we're overrun with beasts.
Tungdil took the beer offered to him by Malin, and they clinked tankards to the warriors' claps and cheers. Tungdil was well pleased. It seemed the friendship pledged at the Black Saddle had become a reality for the dwarfs and men. He watched as the assorted warriors sat around the fires and tucked into something that smelled tantalizingly of roasted meat and soup. Conversation focused on the recent victory. The men described how they felled an orc or killed a bognil, waving their spoons as they talked. When they were done, the dwarves laughed appreciatively, lifted their bowls to slurp their soup, and shared some good-humored banter with their new friends.
To think it took Nodon to bring us together, Tungdil smiled and picked his way between the groups.
He heard deep dwarven voices describing the beauty of their mountain homelands. A few paces further, a couple of Malin's soldiers were teaching battle songs to a cluster of dwarves. He watched and listened contentedly.
If only Belindis were here as well.
Belindis, the expedition's comely smith, had kindled the fires of his furnace, filling him with longing and desire.
At least I'd be able to. I'm telling you, it's not just one, he heard a soldier say softly.
The urgency in his voice distracted Tungdil from his thoughts.
It's spreading. I've seen three of them already.
Tungdil stopped beside him.
What's spreading?
He asked.
Three of what?
He noticed the badge on the man's lightweight leather armor. He was a scout.
Dead Glades, the man said hesitantly. At least that's what I call them.
He pointed to the hills and ran a hand over the stubby blades of new grass.
It's like this. The perished land lost its power when Nodon died. Palandiel blessed the earth and gave it new life, but the evil is buried below the surface.
He glanced at the little group of men and dwarves who were putting away their food with varying regard to politeness. Everyone was listening attentively, especially the dwarves.
You haven't seen what I've seen, he continued. There are pockets of Girdlegard where the evil has taken root.
You mean the perished land is lurking below the surface? Said Tungdil, all other thoughts forgotten.
The scout nodded.
I talked to the locals near one of the glades. They told me about a few poor devils who stayed among the trees. Only three came back, and they attacked their neighbors, fighting and raging with the strength of 10 until the villagers chopped off their heads. King Bruron heard about it and issued a decree. Now the dead glades are blocked with palisades, walls, and moats. No one can enter or leave on punishment of death.
He reached for his tankard.
Mark my words, it's spreading through the land.
Tungdil opened his mouth to reply, but was rudely interrupted.
There you are, scholar. Still moping about? Boomed Boindil.
At the sight of his friend, Tungdil stopped worrying about the insidious powers of the glades.
You're not thinking about women folk, are you? Continued Boindil. I must say, for someone who doesn't know a thing about dwarf women, you've bagged yourself a lovely lass.
He clinked tankards with Tungdil.
To the finest firstling smith, may she bring you true happiness.
He paused, and when he continued, his voice was tinged with sadness.
I reckon you deserve it.
You'll find someone who makes you happy soon enough, said Tungdil, remembering his friend's tragic past.
He raised his tankard.
How about a toast to Boendal? I dare say I miss him as much as you do. He must be fit for battle by now.
Boindil gulped down the rest of his beer.
I killed my happiness, he said slowly, his left hand tightening around the haft of his axe. I killed it with my own hands.
He stared absently into the fire. The flames flickered over his furrowed features, revealing his inner torment.
Now all I can do is fight.
They sat in silence until Boindil started singing. One by one, the other dwarfs joined in. It was another of Bavaragor's songs.
On they march, the orc invaders, driven by greed and lust. Teon loves to plague our borders, it was ever thus. But the dwarves are here to fight them, it was ever thus. Dwarven axes, dwarven hammers, smash their skulls and spill their blood, until the orcs are slain and vanquished, it was ever thus. Tirelessly we guard our borders, doughty children of the smith, and when our kinsmen fall in battle, it was ever thus. Our souls are summoned to Vrakas' smithy. It was ever thus. Eternal warmth, eternal fire. It was ever thus. We seek no praise, we need no thanks. It was ever thus. We do our duty, we do it gladly. It was ever thus. Our axe is sharp, our chainmail glistens. It was ever thus. No beast can breach the dwarves' defences. It was ever thus.
Malin's men sat in hushed silence, while the deep, sonorous voices sung of honour, loyalty, and service to Girdlegard. The men, although ignorant of the dwarven language, had no trouble understanding the music, which seemed to come straight from the soul. The chorus of voices echoed over the hills, carried across the valleys, and soared to the stars. The singing stirred the hearts and minds of everyone in the camp. Tungdil's thoughts were still buzzing when he made his way to bed. He remembered the scout's description of the dead glades.
"What new evil is this, Fracas? It seems our worries aren't yet over."
He decided to investigate further as soon as he had the chance. A moment later, he was asleep. The next morning, it was time for the men and dwarves to part. Tungdil and his warriors would travel underground through the network of tunnels to the Secondling Kingdom, while Malin's men would make their way on foot, in carriages or on horseback, to Eiderslain. The dwarves tramped through the battlefield and lowered themselves into the shaft, glad to get away from the circling ravens and the overwhelming stench. Boindil led the way. With every rung of the ladder, he seemed to shed a little of the sorrow from the previous night. He was looking forward to the journey and to being reunited with his brother, whom they had left in the care of the firstlings to recover from the Alfar attack.
"It's the longest we've ever been parted," he said as
Tungdil reached the bottom of the ladder. They set off toward the wagons that would carry them through the underground network.
"How are you coping?"
Boindil tugged his braided beard and pulled out a stray leaf that didn't belong there.
"It's hard," he admitted with a sigh. "You curb my temper better than anyone except Boendal, but I'm calmer when he's around."
He thought for a moment.
"It's like hobbling around on one leg. I can manage, but part of me is missing. Boendal knows what I'm thinking before I do. It's not the same without him. Even fighting doesn't help."
Tungdil sensed that he was holding back.
"What is it, Boindil? Something was bothering you last night."
I'm not sure how to describe it," said Boindil, considering. "I've got a bad feeling, almost like a chill. The worst of the winter is over, but my insides are frozen. What if Boendal is in danger?"
They turned a corner and stopped abruptly. Tungdil, forgetting what he was about to say, gaped at the devastation. The roof of the tunnel had caved in, and a wall of rubble blocked their way. Worse still, their wagons were buried beneath the rock. Growling indignantly, Boindil bent down and reached for a scrap of metal protruding from the mess. He pulled on it casually. Then, muscles tensing, he gave it an almighty tug. The warped piece of wagon came away in his hand.
"It was their blasted horses," he said irritably. "Their stupid clodhopping made the tunnel collapse."
He tossed the metal away carelessly. Tungdil suspected that the real blame lay with the quake. After Nodon's defeat, the Black Saddle had been hit by a terrible tremor that, judging by reports from the Allies' scouts, had shaken every village in Gerdlegard. It stood to reason that the ancient network of tunnels would be damaged.
"I hope the Dwarven Kingdoms fared better."
"Change of plan," he said to the others.
He gestured to the surface.
"We'll have to look for another entrance."
His confident manner belied his concern. Strictly speaking, it wasn't safe to travel through the tunnels until the structure had been checked. Certain sections of the network could be negotiated only by swooping downhill, and a collision would result in certain death.
"Maybe we should do the whole journey on foot or by pony trap," he thought as they clambered to the surface.
It was 300 miles to the Black Saddle and another 600 to the Secondling Kingdom in the Blue Range. Travelling underground, the distance could be covered in a matter of orbits. Walking would take an eternity.
"Does someone want to stop us getting to the Firstlings? Is Gerdlegard in danger?"
His vague misgivings hardened into an unshakable sense of dread that yesterday's victory could do nothing to allay. At last, they reached the surface, and he hauled himself out of the shaft. "I want everyone moving as fast as possible. Get together in pairs or groups to carry the wounded. It's time we got home." They used the sun to find their bearings and headed east. On reaching the crest of a hill above the battlefield, they came to a sudden halt.
"By Berowyn's beard, it's a camp!" exclaimed Boindil, peering down the far slope.
He sniffed the air and examined the ground. The earth had been churned up by thousands of boots.
"Another army of runts," he growled.
He set off at a run, followed by the others, and stopped at the bottom of the hill. Bending down, he ran a hand over the footprints, sniffed the soil, and spat.
"I'll give them a taste of my axes," he vowed,
fixing his eyes on the broad channel of muddy earth that the orcish troopers had left in their wake.
"They're heading north."
Tungdil looked in vain for evidence of a campfire. Two of his warriors called to him from a knoll. There were more orcish footprints and a couple of dead troopers under a tree. Ravens had clustered over the bodies and were squawking and fighting for their share of the prey. Judging by the evidence, the orcs had been killed the previous orbit. The birds had ripped away the dark green flesh, exposing the bone.
"They were watching us," said Tungdil,
praying that Boindil wouldn't chase after them.
"They must have waited up here while their cousins were dying. They saw which way the battle was going and left."
"Miserable cowards,"
snapped Ireheart, aiming a kick at one of the corpses. The nearest raven hopped away awkwardly, flapping its wings.
"Trust the runty villains to hide from us. I wouldn't have minded a proper fight."
He turned to Tungdil.
4,000 of them, minimum. They're on their way north."
"It doesn't make sense," said Tungdil, baffled.
He picked up an empty water pouch and dropped it hurriedly because of the awful smell.
"The odds were in their favor. You'd expect them to attack."
He paused, deciding what to do.
"I want to see what they're up to,"
he announced, knowing that his plan would meet with Secondling's approval.
"We'll follow them."
Dwarves weren't particularly fleet of foot, and orcs were naturally faster, but it was probably worth a shot.
"Huzzah!" whooped Ireheart. 50 of us, 4,000 of them. That's 400 for every..."
He broke off, remembering his brother in the Firstling Kingdom. Their reunion would be delayed. His face dropped.
"Hang on," said Tungdil. "We're not going to fight them. We're going to see what they're up to."
He dispatched a couple of messengers to chase after Malin and tell him the news. Another 20 warriors were instructed to spread out in all directions and warn the villagers of Goregar about the orcish army.
"Tell them to take to the hills or seek refuge in the towns," Tungdil instructed them.
"Do you see that?"
said Boindil, pointing at the orcish corpses.
"Whoever beheaded them was wasting his time. They were stabbed to death first."
"I expect their chief was making an example of them," reasoned Tungdil. "He probably wanted to bring his troopers into line."
"Maybe,"
Boindil said doubtfully.
"But this one was stabbed 3 times before they chopped off his head. A chief would kill with a single strike."
He raised his arm and made a noise like a whooshing axe.
"Whoosh! It's a sign of strength and precision."
"I suppose you've got a better explanation,"
said Tungdil. Boindil was unconvinced by Tungdil's theory, but he couldn't think how else to explain the trooper's wounds. The discussion ended there. They set off toward the north of Goregar. The terrain became craggier and more barren with every mile. Green meadows gave way to bare earth, rocks, and the occasional tuft of grass. Thankfully, the orcs had left an unmistakable trail of food scraps and boot prints, which saved the dwarves the trouble of checking their route.
"I wonder if we'll see a dead glade," murmured Tungdil. "Did you hear what Malin's scout was saying?"
Boindil looked at him blankly.
"A dead glade? Sounds like something to be avoided."
Tungdil filled him in on what the scout had said. "Dead glades are patches of forest inhabited by the perished land. King Bruron banned his subjects from approaching them because the evil affects their brains. You can tell a dead glade by the color of the trees. They're completely black."
"I thought the perished land had retreated," growled Boindil. "We can't let it hide in the trees."
Tungdil kept his eyes on the churned-up path. "I'll ask Andukai to deal with it. The perished land is a canker. Who knows how far it might spread?" Slowing his pace, the secondling fell back and instructed the rest of the company to look out for black trees. Anything suspicious should be reported to King Bruron. During the second orbit of marching, the tracks turned sharply to the east, heading straight for the highest hill. The sudden change in direction and the unnecessary ascent indicated that the orcs had left their original course. On the third orbit of marching, the dwarves, defying the odds, succeeded in closing on the longer-legged, faster orcs. They watched from a distance of barely 2 miles as the beasts swarmed up a hill and disappeared over the crest.
"Oink, oink!"
grunted Boindil in excitement. Tungdil shot him a warning look. "We're not going to fight them," he said, laying a restraining hand on the secondling's arm. "We wouldn't stand a chance." They set off in pursuit, this time taking care to stay hidden. They ascended the steep, stony slope and stopped just short of the crest. Tungdil took off his helmet and his long brown hair billowed in the breeze. Keeping low to the ground, he edged forward and lifted his head slowly so that only his eyes and his crown were visible over the summit. Boindil crawled across the trampled ground to join him. Their excitement turned to alarm. The orcs were streaming into a dark, wooded area. Tungdil stared at the trees with their black trunks and bare branches. The beasts were heading for a pool of water, the inky content of which was lapping against the stony shore and staining it black. Tungdil had a fair idea what he was looking at.
"A dead glade," he whispered. "It stands to reason, I suppose."
Boindil peered at the orcs incredulously.
"What are they doing? Surely they don't mean to stay there. Even by orcish standards, it's a hellhole."
Tungdil could tell that his friend was itching for a fight.
"We are not going in," he said sternly. "We'll tell King Bruron that we found another dead glade. He'll make sure that the orcs stay where they are. They won't be leaving here alive."
Raising his head a little, he surveyed the bare treetops and tried to gauge the size of the glade. It measured at least 1 mile in each direction, a vast blotch of foreboding and death. Just then a familiar odor came up to him on the wind. He wrinkled his nose in disgust. It was the smell of brackish water that had permeated the drinking pouch, but this time it was coming from the sinister pool.
"Fancy a sip?"
Boindil made retching noises.
"I'd sooner die than drink it."
Tungdil broke into a cold sweat as he remembered what the scout had said. The humans who strayed into the dead glades were beheaded by their fellow men. He stared at the inky pool.
What if the 2 dead orcs had drunk the fated water and gone mad? Was that why they were stabbed and beheaded?
For an answer, he stopped worrying and crawled down the slope to make his report to the other dwarves. After a long wait, a delegation of Bruron's men arrived and Tungdil gave them a detailed account of what he had witnessed.
"It's time we went home," he announced.
Even Boindil was happy with the change of plan. The prospect of seeing his brother outweighed the appeal of another battle, and he was looking forward to a solid dwarven meal, washed down with a tankard of Gerdlegard's finest beer. They set off on the long journey home. Lorimber's Folk, Thirdling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, Winter 6234th, 6235th Solar Cycle.
"Bislipor overreached himself," said a deep voice.
The lofty walls threw back the words as a toneless echo. Then it was quiet in the chamber. Only the fire continued to spit and crackle. An armored hand balled itself into a fist, the articulated fingers creaking as the spikes on the knuckles rose menacingly.
"Cycles of plotting, and for what? I knew it would come to nothing."
"The other folks are weak, Your Majesty. Hundreds died at the Black Saddle. The situation can still be turned to our advantage."
The red glow from the fire accentuated the terrible scars on his gleaming scalp. Contrary to appearances, the lines had been cut by a thirdling tattooist, not an enemy sword. The sequence of dwarven runes spelled death and destruction to the enemies of his kingdom, and his artfully chiseled skull was fearsome to behold.
"They lost their best warriors in the battle with Nodon's hordes. It left them crippled and toothless."
His kinsman leaned forward. His long black hair was streaked with grey and braided into three plaits that sat neatly against his scalp.
"We're not ready for open warfare."
The thirdling commander-in-chief shrugged, causing his tunic, a finely crafted shirt of interlocking plates and chain mail, to jangle.
"Name me a better time, Lorimbas Steelheart. We haven't been as strong as this in 200 cycles."
"My plan is more subtle, Salfalor Shieldbreaker," replied the thirdling king.
His beard was stiff with dye, hanging like an overstretched pennant from his chin. Even when he talked, the red, grey and brown whiskers stayed perfectly rigid. He leaned over the table and studied a map of Gerdlegard.
"Bislipur's mistake was to move too slowly. My goal shall be achieved within a decade."
He rose from his marble chair and signalled for his commander-in-chief to follow. The hall where they held their briefings was dimly lit, with specks of iron pyrite glittering weakly in the dark stone walls. The two dwarves seemed to be walking through nothingness with only a smattering of sparkling stars. A line of triangular pillars hewn from the flesh of the mountain stretched toward a set of stairs. Lorimbas ascended them quickly and threw open the doors to reveal a golden shrine. Lorimber, foundling father of the thirdlings, rested here. His coffin stood upright, his marble likeness staring out from the lid. Dwarven runes made of diamonds, precious stones and gems praised his deeds and exhorted his descendants to avenge and destroy. Lorimbas bowed his head respectfully.
"Too long have we endured their scorn," he muttered absently.
He reached out with his right hand and caressed the cold effigy.
"Too many times we have failed in our duty to avenge the injustices suffered by our founder. The time is ripe, Thirdling Father. Your bidding will be done, and your faithful son, Lorimbas Steelheart of the Clan of the Stone Grinders, ruler of your children, will drive the descendants of Berowin, Boringar, Goimdil, and Giselbert from their kingdoms."
He kneeled down, unhooked a three-flanged mace from his belt, and held it toward the dead king.
"This I promise on my life."
Salfalor joined him at the coffin and dropped to his knees. There was no need for him to speak. Lorimbas had given full expression to the passion that burned wordlessly in his soul. Head bowed, with the lethal spike of his double-headed hammer inclined respectfully to the coffin, Salfalor vowed silently to uphold the thirdling cause. Hours passed as they prayed together, so absorbed in their devotion that their aching arms and bruised knees barely registered in their minds. At last, Lorin Bass rose, kissed the sacred boots of his ancestor, and locked the shrine. Salphalor lingered for a moment, gazing at the shimmering gold doors. Like all thirdlings, he loved the founder of his kingdom better than Vrakus, who had forsaken his bold-minded son. Lorimber's crime was to insist on his right to choose his own name. The flint-willed dwarf, who possessed a special measure of that dwarven quality referred to as obduracy, had argued until he achieved his purpose, but in doing so he displeased the dwarven god. His brothers each received a talent, but Lorimber was condemned to mediocrity, and his descendants never fully mastered the dwarven arts. Salphalor leaned forward and studied the doors. In his eyes, the inscriptions looked beautiful, but a firstling would compare the metalwork to the imperfect efforts of a human smith. "They'll pay for their arrogance," he vowed darkly, flexing his muscles. He wore heavy vambraces, equipped with knives to protect his arms in battle. "What did you have in mind, Your Majesty?" he asked, bowing his head as he descended backward from the shrine. The king followed him down the steps, and they returned to the marble table to study the map.
"We'll drive a wedge between them and shatter their alliance," said the king, reaching for a pitcher and filling their silver tankards with beer. The index finger of his right hand hovered over the black saddle. "The thirdlings built that stronghold, and I intend to get it back. It's ours by right."
He raised his tankard.
"To our cousins for restoring its defences."
He drank thirstily and replaced the tankard on the table with a noisy clunk.
"Well?"
he prompted, eyeing his silent commander.
"What you say?"
The plan made little sense to Salphalor, who didn't mind airing his concerns.
"What use is the stronghold, Your Majesty? If it's the tunnels you're interested in, we've got access to them here."
Lorimbas smiled.
"The tunnels, exactly.
Remember when we first heard how our stronghold had been taken over by the dwarven army? I sent our scholars to do some digging in the archives. They came back with some fascinating information about the Black Saddle. Our dwarven cousins have no idea."
Salphalor sipped his beer and looked at the king intently.
"They've been ensconced in the stronghold for orbits. How can you be sure?"
"Trust me, faithful warrior. They know nothing. If our cousins had discovered the Black Saddle's secret, every dwarf in Girdlegard would know of it by now. News like this travels fast, and our eyes and ears are everywhere. Our spies tell us everything, and they're more subtle than Bislipur."
He handed Salphalor the archivist's findings, a packet of manuscripts tied with a ribbon and a stack of engraved tablets. The commander-in-chief glanced at them briefly and waved his hand dismissively.
"They're in the old tongue," he snapped. "I can't read them."
Lorimbas stared at Salphalor's bloodshot left eye, the distinguishing feature of the Red Eye clan, and nodded in satisfaction.
"That's the beauty of it. Hardly anyone can read the ancient script. The Black Saddle will be in our hands before anyone fathoms its secret."
"True,"
said Salphalor slowly. He took a deep breath.
"But how will we persuade the other folks to leave the stronghold? To fight them would be..."
"None of our kinsmen will lose their lives."
The king laughed cruelly and leaned back in his chair.
"We won't be doing the fighting. We'll get someone to do it for us."
"Who would fight for the Thirdling cause?"
"King Bruron of Goregar."
Salphalor's bushy brown eyebrows knitted together in a frown.
"This is worthy of Bislipur," he said reprovingly. "I thought we'd agreed that scheming is useless. So far I can't see the merit of the plan.
He wrapped his hands around the haft of his hammer, an imposing weapon that almost matched him in height.
"I should have explained myself more clearly from the start," the king said smoothly. "Our archives turned out to be most instructive. The scholars found an ancient treaty dating back to the end of the 4000th cycle. It seems our ancestors signed a pact with Goragar, which grants our kingdom everlasting ownership of Cloudpiercer in payment for our help."
"You mean the Black Saddle?"
Salphalor knew the stories about the mountain's history. According to legend, the Black Saddle was once a mighty peak named Cloudpiercer, the summit of which stretched thousands of paces into the sky. Cloudpiercer stood taller and prouder than any other peak in Girdlegard. It was tipped with snow throughout the seasons, and its loftiest flanks were made of pure gold. After trying and failing to mine the treasure, the people of Goragar had called on the dwarves to help them.
"Are you saying our kinsmen helped the humans to mine the gold, just like the legend says?"
"Exactly. The dwarves of Lorimbar were the first to send a delegation to Goragar."
Lorimbas gestured to the map.
"They arrived at Cloudpiercer and succeeded in burrowing their way through the mountain and digging a tunnel to the top. They hollowed out the mountain and carried off the gold. In return for their help, they demanded a share of the treasure and ownership of the mountain. The king of Goragar signed a treaty to that effect."
Salphalor knew the rest from a song that his aunt had taught him as a child. The dwarves and men had quarreled over the gold, prompting Cloudpiercer to erupt in fury and shake the miners from its core. The rest of the mountain was riddled with tunnels, and the peak collapsed. From that moment on, the mountain simmered with hatred and harbored a murderous grudge against the races of dwarves and men.
"What if the mountain recognizes us and tries to bury us under its weight?"
he asked nervously.
"That part of the story is almost certainly hogwash. But we'll be careful all the same."
The king was still staring at the map.
"Bruron should receive my missive in the next few orbits."
"Bruron is a man without principles. He'll never honor the word of his ancestors,"
Salphalor predicted dourly.
"Besides, without the help of the other folks, his kingdom would have fallen to the Magus. He'll deny all knowledge of our agreement rather than risk the anger of the dwarves."
"Humans will do anything for gold. It's simply a case of scale. A single coin won't buy a sovereign's loyalty, so I'm offering 2 full chests. How can he refuse? His kingdom was ransacked by orcs and his people will be hungry. He needs money to buy grain."
Lorimbas sat back and folded his hands across his chest.
"You see, Salphalor? I can fight with my head as well as my mace. I can out-scheme poor Bislipper."
Salphalor's tattoos snaked across his face as he ground his teeth.
"I don't doubt it, Your Majesty. But what did Bislipper achieve?"
"Patience, old friend. The first stage of the plan deals only with Bruron."
"Where would you strike next?"
Lorimbas's finger hovered over the map and landed on the kingdom of Ida's Slain.
"Orcs are marauding through Malin's kingdom. He'll want to destroy them, or drive them into Toboribor. We'll wait until he's busy. Then we'll pay him a visit."
"Malin and Goldhand are friends. All the money in Girdlegard won't change his allegiance."
The commander-in-chief frowned.
"I'm sorry, Your Majesty, but scheming won't get you further than poor Bislipur."
"You'd rather we went to war,"
the king said coldly, fixing his commander with his dark brown eyes.
"I don't doubt that the odds have never seemed better. Our army is strong and the others are weak from their battle with Nodon."
He broke off and raised a warning finger.
"But numbers count for nothing while the alliance still holds. We need to kindle the hatred between our cousins and the elves. Once we've stoked the fires of enmity, we'll forge new wedges, wedges that will isolate Gandogar and the others from the humans and the elves.
It took more than flashing eyes and a raised voice to intimidate Salphalor.
I wish you every success, he said, undaunted. What are my orders? Tell our mercenaries to listen for the code word Lorimbur's Revenge. When the time comes, they must lay down their arms and fight only in self-defense. Tell them not to be tempted by offers of gold.
The king rested his chin on his hands and fell silent. Dark thoughts forced their way into his mind, swamping him with fear, self-doubt, and despair.
Are you worried about your daughter?
Lorimbas sat up sharply, startled from his thoughts. Salphalor was right. He was worried about his daughter, who had been missing for half a cycle.
Still no news, he said with a shake of the head.
There had been no message, no sighting, not the slightest indication of where she was or whether she was alive.
I'd sooner carry all the peaks in Gerdlagar than endure this silence.
Have faith, Lorimbas. She's a good daughter and an excellent wife. Salphalor's face softened for the first time that orbit. I trained her in the art of combat, and you taught her to dissemble. She won't let us down. He stared at the fireplace, watching the flickering flames.
It's time she sent word.
His left hand clenched into a fist, his gauntlet creaking. Lorimbas sighed.
A single word, a single syllable would calm our fears. It's hard, I know. I miss my daughter. You miss your wife. But what choice did we have? No one else could achieve our purpose without arousing their suspicions.
He was trying to drown out the voice of his conscience, which reminded him that he was endangering his youngest daughter by sending her on a mission that relied on total secrecy. He bowed his head and closed his eyes.
I had no choice, he whispered.
Chapter 2 Berowyn's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, Winter, 6,234th, 6,235th Solar Cycle.
It's still a horse. Just a small one, that's all,
grumbled Boindil, sliding down from the pony's saddle. He gave himself a good shake, showering sand from his clothes and beard.
If Rakkus had wanted us to be riders, he would have given us better padding.
He winced as he rubbed his backside.
You'd be complaining about your blisters if we'd walked, retorted Tungdil with a smile.
Like Boindil, he was coated from head to toe with sand, fine grains of which had snuck through the garments, clinging to the fabric and rubbing against his skin. He dismounted and ran a hand over his pony's mane.
Don't listen to the old curmudgeon, he told the pony. You did an excellent job.
They were standing on the outermost terrace of Ogre's Death, one of the most imposing strongholds in Gerdlegard, home to the secondling dwarfs. Its keep had been hewn into the rock, with battlements extending down the mountainside in four separate terraces. Until recently, no one had believed that Ogre's Death would ever be conquered, but Nodon had proved that defences could be breached. With the help of the treacherous Bislipur, the Magus's beasts had stormed the stronghold and laid waste to the secondlings' halls. Now the stronghold was a hive of activity. Cranes were lifting, wheels turning, winches hoisting, and saws slicing through the rock. Dust filled the air, and the blue range echoed with a thousand hammers and chisels as hordes of industrious masons rebuilt what the beasts had destroyed. The rubble from the ruined battlements had been carted away, and the fortifications were rising again. Only this time, the defences would be bigger, heavier, and stronger. Soon, the secondlings would be safe from invaders once more.
It's good to see order returning to the kingdom,
thought Tongdil, trying to overcome his nagging fears.
I shouldn't worry so much.
Boindil interrupted his thoughts.
Ah, look at Ogre's death rising from the ruins, he said proudly. The secondling flags are flying from the stronghold, and the bones of the invaders have been scattered across the range. They thought they destroyed us, but our spirit can't be crushed.
Quickening his pace, he made straight for the vast gateway, 8 paces wide and 10 paces high, leading from the uppermost terrace to the underground halls. Tungdil looked up at the flagpoles. On the last stage of their journey through Sangpur, the flags had been visible as tiny squares of cloth, but now he could make out the details. The colours of the firstlings and fourthlings flew proudly beside the crests of the 17 secondling clans. He tapped his forehead.
The assembly meeting.
It had slipped his mind entirely.
By my beard, Boindil,
he called out to the secondling, who was practically at the gateway. Another orbit and we would have missed the coronation. Boindil stopped in his tracks.
To think a pack of orcs and Bognilim could make us forget a thing like that. It wouldn't have happened if Boindil had been with us.
A look of consternation crossed his face, and he sniffed the air anxiously.
It's all right, he declared. We haven't missed anything important. They haven't brought out the food.
The other dwarves caught up, and they set off together through the gateway into the Secondling Kingdom. The passageway delved through the mountain, leading to ornately carved chambers supported by soaring columns. Ahead of them towered an enormous stone statue of Beruin, seated on a white marble throne. They filed between his feet and entered the corridor leading to the assembly hall.
"Remember what happened last time?"
Boindil asked softly.
"How could I forget?"
Every detail of that orbit was etched on Tungdil's mind. On arriving at Ogre's death, he and the twins had entered the great hall to find the delegates warring among themselves. Soon after, he had embarked on a long journey, a journey that turned him into a proper dwarf.
"It's a mercy to be out of the light,"
said Boindil, whose hair had been bleached by the harsh desert sun.
"We belong in the mountains, as Vrakas intended."
He gave his plate a good shake to dislodge the sand.
"Do you think the delegates will be arguing again?"
Tungdil shook his head. "Gandalgar is the legitimate heir, and no one could dispute his right to the throne. He proved his character as soon as he freed himself from Bislipur's wiles." The secondling grinned.
"Not as much as you proved yours."
"I don't want to be High King, Boindil. My calling lies elsewhere."
Raising his hand decisively, he knocked 3 times, took a deep breath, and pushed open the mighty stone doors. Light streamed toward them. Blinking, Tungdil gazed in horror at the ruins of the hall. Barely half of the towering cylindrical columns had survived the beast's invasion, and it was only thanks to the secondling's expert masonry that the ceiling hadn't collapsed. Tungdil's heart sank as he looked at the desecrated tablets and the base reliefs on the walls. The orcs had attacked the artwork with clubs and cudgels, smashing the marble and destroying the carefully chiseled chronicle of past victories and heroic deeds. Glancing at his companion, he saw the secondling's expression change from horror to fury. Boindil, already a ferocious orc slayer, was planning his revenge. Lanterns and braziers lit the chamber, casting a warm glow over 5 magnificent chairs, one for each folk, arranged in a semicircle around a marble table. Tungdil spotted Gandugar Silverbeard, ruler of the Fourthlings and head of Goimdil's line. Seated beside him was Xamtis the Second of the Clan of the Stubborn Streaks, Queen of the Firstlings and ruler of Borengar's folk, and Belendalin Onearm of the Clan of the Strong Fingers, former counsellor to Gundrabor Whitecrown, the late High King. Belendalin had been crowned King of the Secondlings after Gundrabur's death. The remaining delegates, chieftains, elders from the Firstling, Secondling, and Fourthling kingdoms, had taken their places in the elegantly carved pews behind their leaders and were talking among themselves. Scanning the ranks of the First